Welcome to another exciting episode of the NIDS View, a weekly show of the National Institute for Deterrence Studies, where we are advancing peace, promoting stability, and helping you to think deterrence. Each week, we discuss and analyze a recent topic and provide insight into how it affects our national deterrence. We hope you enjoy this show.
Welcome back to another great episode of the NIDS View, where we discuss current topics of the day in many respects. It's a roundtable discussion. Now, of course, I am Adam Lowther, and this week I'm joined by Mike Carey and Alex Littlefield. Curtis and Jim Petrosky they had a meeting this week, I think is where they're at. So I'm joined by Mike and Alex, and they're actually two perfect guys to talk about a topic that was inspired by Amit Gupta, who said, you know what, Adam, I don't hear enough discussion about what comes after the war in Ukraine, and then what do we do about China if, you know, they attack Taiwan, and then what? So sort of long-range thinking about what do we do post, you know, the current war in Ukraine and after Taiwan. And so I thought Mike, who knows the Russians, knows them well, and Alex, who spent 20 years in Taiwan and China, so he knows China well. So who better to have this discussion with than Mike Carey and Alex Littlefield? So with that, let me toss the first question over to you, Mike, and that is this question of the war in Ukraine will end. It might end a year from now. It might end 6 months from now. It might end 2 years, 3 years from now, but it'll end. And it either ends in Russian victory, Russian defeat, or some sort of negotiated settlement where nobody's happy. But it ends. So when that day comes, how should the United States and NATO primarily deal with Russia from that point forward? Do we punish? Do we try to bring them closer? Do we seek regime change? What do we do? What's your take on that?
So I think that, Adam, and I'm really glad to have been invited to have this conversation on the NIDS View, my premier, if you will, event here. I have a lot of thoughts about the answers to your questions and the different facets of it. You know, what we do next as the United States and as NATO, if you will, and how we deal with Russia has an awful lot to do with one of those three end states, as you categorize them, right? Is there, you know, how did the hot war conclude, right? That's going to have a lot of contextual elements that get played both economically, politically, and by definition militarily. So it's really unclear to me to my crystal ball is not clear on how that'll happen. But one thing that I believe is pretty certain is we need to not look at the conclusion through exclusively Western eyes, right? Which is, I think, our natural tendency because it's who we are. Because there's a rest of world view, there's a NATO view that is not holistic, it's not monolithic. Hungary has a very different view of this situation than does Sweden, for example, than does France. And so working through those types of relationships to create a solution set that goes beyond one that is one of animosity and hostility perpetuated. You know, what you don't want is another Versailles Treaty. Right, that's not going to lend itself to good history repeating itself, and you also don't want total absolution, because that just begets a bad behavior without further impact. So I think there's got to be a complex package, simple enough to be executed and enforced, and verified or whatever however you want to position it. but sophisticated enough that it's not just a blunt force tool. You can't, I don't believe that punishing Russia, like, boom, in some way is executable readily. I just see that as being not a long play solution. It might work for a short term, but it's not a long play solution. I think when you see things in the press, like, you know, the maritime border has been modified today, you know, unilaterally, you go, okay, that's, you know, that's in response, I believe, into, you know, into the NATO expansion. And so more pushing will beget more pushing back. And so if the conclusion is something akin to the 38th parallel, that creates a different relationship with Russia than we've had historically, as opposed to what we've had previously. And in Russia's behaviors, I think generally fairly predictable. But I would say that we've been sketchy on accuracy, on what they're going to do next. And even if we've known, I think that it hasn't informed decision-making adequately in order to preclude it, or we've not been able to stall whatever advances necessarily that have been forthcoming. So I think that the future requires us to have the ability to stall future aggression without creating an unstable state.
And then this sort of lends to a second aspect of it, which is the idea that we don't want to drive Russia into the China camp even further than we already have. So I wonder if any solution to how we deal with Russia post-Ukraine is one that needs to address making sure that, you know, like you said, it can't be too punitive, because for one, punitive solutions will drive Russia towards China. And that certainly is one I don't think we want. Alex, jump in here. How do we deal with Russia in a way that we don't reinforce this, you know, friendship without limits, this budding alliance between Russia and China? And then, you know, even North Korea is now getting in on it.
Yeah, so if we're talking about Russia and just the United States, and then Russia, China, there's a lot going on there. For example, Russia is just this week alone, they sent another satellite up in space that is a counter satellite. And there's 2019, 2022, they've been sending things up there as well. So that's a threat to us, of course, but it also threatens the Chinese, because the Chinese have assets in space, probably much more so than Russia. So some of the things Russia does probably does alarm China. What's happening in Ukraine, though, probably, as far as China's concerned, it's no sweat off their back, because they're not interested in Ukraine, but they are interested in the Russian Far East. And as long as Russia's invested and distracted with Europe and in the West, that frees up the Russian Far East probably for China. So China benefits by this war in Ukraine on many fronts. And Russia's approach towards it and using nuclear weapons and threatening to, because just this week, again, the Russians had been doing exercises with tactical nuclear weapons. And also they've nationalized Western firms in Russia. They just did that again this week. Carlsberg, the beer from Denmark, and I think believe it's JP Morgan or someone, they've been nationalizing our firms over there. So they're buckling down, getting ready for war. And if we keep pushing, then they're going to push back harder. And, you know, they're using, I believe the Russians and the Chinese both, when they think of nuclear deterrence, in case of like China, for them, the term nuclear deterrence in Chinese doesn't mean deterrence. It actually means threat. So what we call deterrence, they call threat. So they, whether it's peacetime or wartime, they see their nuclear capability as a way to coerce and a threat, and I believe the Russians do too. So they use their deterrent, what we think of as a deterrent, to threaten and to coerce. So they're both sides are trying to coerce us, China in the Pacific, Russia in Europe, and we don't wield, first of all, we don't have as many capabilities and delivery systems. We don't wield it as effectively in terms of strategy and coercion and threatening, because we have a status quo we want to maintain, which was kind of this world of peace and liberal order. And it would be inconsistent with us as leaders of this liberal order to now be behaving like an authoritarian power, using our very weak nuclear deterrent as a coercive mechanism to get China and Russia to get on board with the liberal war order we've been trying to establish ever since, you know, in earnest ever since the end of the Cold War. So that we have two revisionist powers. Russia might have a different view than China, but what they have in common is they don't want to be a part of this American-led world order. And so they probably are starting to do what they can to dismantle our system and to, at some point, establish something that one or the other can be to lead or co-lead with.
So as you look, Mike, at this, the war in Ukraine, how do you see this ending? Do you see it ending anytime soon? Do you see it in many respects? I sort of see it much like the war, you know, the Eastern Front in World War II, where the Russians took heavy losses and then ultimately they just threw enough manpower and enough material into the fight to grind down, you know, the Nazis. And then eventually the Nazis just didn't have enough oomph left. And so, therefore, they started pulling back. And I don't really see, you know, Ukraine is a finite population of, you know, 40-ish million people. They've, you know, 6 million or so have fled. The, you know, Russia's about, what, 140 million? So they're going to throw their manpower into this until they grind down the Ukrainians and there's not much left. And then through attrition and through trying to wear down NATO and the United States, we eventually say, man, we've dumped a lot of money into this and we're not seeing success. Maybe we should just give up. And then eventually the Russians succeed. That's, in some respects, that's how I see this, is this just attrition. And then, so, am I wrong? Okay. Am I right? And then what do we do?
Yeah, so two things. One comment you made, Alex, about our weak nuclear deterrent. I would take exception to your phrasing. I don't believe we have a weak nuclear deterrent. I believe a weakening. You know, we are lessening our position of strength for a host of reasons and explanations. But I wouldn't characterize it as weak at this point. And I think that's important because whether it's numbers, delivery systems, or political will, all of that comes together, and as well, you know, technical capability as well as the will, that all comes together to your strength. And I think where we have the weakest part is in the will, demonstrated will, the narrative that we've been hearing for the last 12 years or so on, you know, where do we sit with nuclear and how it's reduced our capability to keep pace. So I don't think we're there yet, but I think we're on the dangerous track that you alluded to. And we could discuss that in another NIDS view or offline. But back to your point, Adam. So the attrition warfare, the grinding of just grinding to the point where the one with the most resources just overwhelms ultimately the exhausted smaller force. I think what that doesn't account for is other outlets, vents, other ways to create pressure points that will cause Russia to think differently about the conflict. You know, it's the elevation of the cost to, you know, what is the changing goal lines of victory, right? You know, what was the initial intent? Is it still the intent? I don't believe so. Do they go back to the original intent? Do they go back out of Crimea? Does it become so painful for them in a host of other ways where it changes the calculus? Does it spread further north in Europe? Do we see acting out, you know, in the Arctic. Do we see acting out by Russia and other places that totally changes the dynamic, so it's no longer a Ukrainian alone fight? And I think that that's where I see it going. I see player in my mind, there are players who would see it, prefer see it get outside the Ukraine for a host of reasons, as opposed to contain it. I have a hard time seeing the stalemate being sustained, because I don't see Russia tolerating it, and I don't see NATO think or Europe tolerating it, frankly. So what does that mean? You know, you just make Ukraine the crucible and everything just gets destroyed there. I think you find other vents. It's kind of like an eruption of a volcano. There's other ports going to let that pressure go. Will we see it in the Baltic? Will we see it, you know, in northern Europe, or will we see it elsewhere in the world? And I think that is something that remains to be seen. It's something that can be influenced, frankly. And so we need to be thoughtful about, you know, Russia's a big place. It's just not the western portion of Russia. I mean, there's an eastern Russia, right, that Alex referred to that China cares about and we care about as well, and Japan cares about. And there's a whole other side of this equation that has yet to be, I think, played out. I'm not recommending an expansion of the conflict. I'm just saying that there's other places for this pressure to express itself, and that will change the dynamic, I think.
So let me ask you then, Alex, what do you think China wants Russia to do in the days, months, and weeks ahead? If they could have Russia do whatever they wanted, what would that be?
That's a really interesting question. I want to go back to what Mike said here. I agree that what happens in Ukraine is not going to, it can't end there. And there's no like possible solution that anyone would be happy with in Ukraine. It's either Ukraine, we go back to what Ukraine was before Russia started taking away their territory, or if there was a Versailles kind of treaty, we know that would be even less useful than the one that ended World War I. So there's not really, it's hard to see any good news or good outcome in the case of Ukraine. And in all likelihood, it probably will spread throughout Europe. So now going to your question more specifically, if China could actually have Russia do whatever they wanted it to do, it benefits in some ways the Chinese for Russia to be distracted, because now that, and the Americans, of course, because now that allows them to focus more on Taiwan and what they're doing over there. And one lesson they probably learned from Ukraine is a kinetic engagement is not a good approach. So they're going to probably do everything they can in their power to coerce Taiwan into submission without firing a single shot. They might, you know, they might do a blockade temporarily, and then people say, well, blockade is too hard to execute, but you could do one for a short time and then take the pressure off, do it again, you know, because Taiwan, it doesn't have a lot of its, I remember, I used to live there, right? So I remember one time they were really short on water, and they were talking about getting water from mainland China, and people were saying, no, we shouldn't get water. Something as basic as water. So they have water reservoirs that they have to rely on. So Taiwan's very vulnerable in terms of just being able to take care of itself. And so there's a lot of weak points where China could put pressure on and just make people thirsty, make people hungry, make people live in the dark and try and say, hey, turn the lights on, turn the faucets on. We don't want this. We want to get closer to you, and probably have people in place in Taiwan who are already ready for this moment and who are ready to make a deal with China to like, so, and the Americans, I don't know that they really want to, engage with China there, because we're only sending weapons, you know, we're sending munitions to Ukraine. What are we going to do in Taiwan? We're not even going to put a single troop in Ukraine. How are we going to put a troop in Taiwan to fight? Like, yeah. We just know that's a losing proposition.
Yeah, the only difference is, you know, we do have sort of long-standing ties to Taiwan. I mean, at one point we had 70,000 American troops. So, you know, we have troops now. Whereas I wonder, in some respects. I'm reading Victor Davis Hanson. He has a new book. I think it's called Like the End of Everything. And the whole point of the book is that he looks at civilizations, great societies that have been wiped off the map. So he looks at, you know, ancient Thebes in Greece, and he looks at Carthage. And then he talks about, well, how did these great societies get wiped off the face of the earth? And in some respects, Ukraine looks very similar to Carthage, where, you know, they returned the Russian nuclear weapons. They did many things to make themselves be innocuous towards the Russians. But then when they finally asserted themselves, which the Carthaginians did the same thing, and prior to the beginning of the Third Punic War, they sort of stood up for themselves. And, you know, the Ukrainians are saying, hey, we want to be part of the European Union, and we want to look west. And then the Russians hammered them. And, you know, the Romans hammered the Carthaginians. And they essentially razed Carthage to the ground. And there was they enslaved the 10% of the population that didn't die in the war. And, the Punic civilization ceased to exist. And in some respects, it seems like the Russians are they trying to accomplish something like this, absorbing, you know, Ukraine back into Russia? Because at one point it was the Ukraine instead of Ukraine. And that's, of course, what Ukrainians fear most, is being reabsorbed in, you know, by the Russians. And then could you not say something similar for Taiwan, except, you know, Taiwan doesn't have a history of being integrated into China. But there's this desire by China, by the People's Republic, to essentially make wipe Taiwanese history and independence and autonomy, wipe it from existence. And then what does the West, what does, you know, in the case of Taiwan, what does Korea, Japan do? Because as you've written in articles, Alex, for Global Security Review, it's not just about Taiwan. They want other islands that belong to the Japanese. And, you know, the Russians, Mike, the Russians, they want the Baltics back, and they want, you know, they want the Russian near abroad. So it's a lot more than that. Tell me, what do you guys see in terms of how this all plays out?
So I'll go ahead and take the part about China wanting more than Taiwan. There's small independence movements in Okinawa and even in Hawaii that are supported by Chinese indigenous independence movements. So and the Chinese can make an argument that historically Okinawa was part of China. It was a tributary state to China. It was I think it was Liuqiu was the empire's name. And if you look at the ancient, like, kind of architecture and history of the place, you can see a very heavy, strong Chinese influence. So they're not going to say it now, but I believe that to them, Okinawa should be theirs and not Japan's. Because Okinawa, of course, isn't really historically Japanese either, right? Because it was the Ryukyu Kingdom, and so with their own language and everything else.
So, Alex, does that become part of the cow's tongue discussion as well?
I'm sorry, the which discussion?
Cow's tongue, the South China Sea falling into...
Oh, yeah, so square. Yeah, they... You mean like when they added the 9-dash line, now they added an extra dash? That dash line will keep extending, as they continue to heat up the pot with all the, what is it, the frogs boiling in the pot. They'll just continue to add dashes. Eventually, those dashes will extend out to Hawaii, and, you know, I'm being a bit provocative, but, you know, San Francisco has a long history of Chinese immigration, so maybe it'll extend out at some point to California.
So is this the new greater Chinese co-prosperity sphere? Is that what we're
Yeah, exactly, about? Right. And they need their Lebensraum and all that good stuff. And California actually was Mexican, and then for a short time it was its own little republic. That's why the flag does say the Republic of California. No good reason it shouldn't belong to China. So you might just need to make longer dashes instead of shorter dashes. So maybe anyhow, but yeah, as some James Bond movie once said, the world is not enough. So it's not like Russia or China are ever going to be satisfied with Ukraine or with Taiwan. That's just the stepping stone to the next thing. And I think we kind of understood that, or someone understood it, if you go back to the Chinese Civil War. We talk about, Ukraine might look like the surface of the moon. But that was kind of what happened in Penghu and Jingmen. Those little islands, there was a tremendous amount of fighting there between the Kuomintang and communists, because they knew, if these two little places fall, then Taiwan's next. So it's just kind of the tripwire, we got to defend it. Even this place looks like Swiss cheese. We're going to try and protect it, because the next thing, we know what comes next. And in the case of Ukraine, it might look like Swiss cheese, which is very sad for the Ukrainians. I don't mean to say that lightly. But then there's the Baltic states, there's Georgia, there's Poland, there's all kinds of people who are in the crosshairs of the Russians.
Yeah, so I'd agree with you, Alex. It's the analogies are interesting, but the reality of what we're seeing, I think, is more useful in drawing a focus to what is happening, what's likely to happen next, is based on the logic that's being put forward, or the arguments that are being put forward, by the Kremlin now. Not, I like to harken back to historical examples, right? And they help you kind of approximate what might happen, but you really have to pay attention to what's being said and done today by the players today, because they're the ones who are also taking that history and have been shaped by their experiences and are looking at, the dissolution of the Soviet Union, the encroachment of NATO onto their borders, the loss of any barrier states, the loss of their economy, and they're reacting to that. So if we think that because there are Russian-speaking people and culturally Russian people in Ukraine, therefore parts of Ukraine should be part of Russia, that's an interesting proposal for a lot of areas that are on the periphery of any country. It's like, well, geez, you speak my language, therefore you must be me. Watch this. I'm going to go take your county. That's a lot of damage could happen right there.
Couldn't that be, that could also work in reverse for the Russians, I would think, because if you look at the Caucasus, for example, those are not Russians.
Right.
There's a lot of parts of Russia where you have non-Russian peoples.
I think that's basis of all kinds of separatist movements around the world, right? I mean, that's, somehow they got homogenized, of late it's pretty commonplace to blame the Allies for redrawing boundaries after World War II without consideration for certain cultural things.
Sure.
And now people are like, hey, they did that wrong. I want to take my land back, 80 years later. It's like, it's kind of a sporty proposition.
Yeah. So if we think, about the end for Russia in a post-war Russia, and we're getting late in the show, does Russia end with Vladimir Putin completing his latest term of office, so he'll be there another, 5 years or so? Does it end that way? Does it end with somebody new as the Russian president? Does the United States pursue regime change in Russia? Is that, because it seems to be a more fragile system than, say, the Chinese system. What does the United States do?
I think that positioning regime change in Moscow is inflammatory to the point of not productive, right? You might wish and pray it does, but I think taking actual action to do that in a direct way, kind of like we did in Libya, that would be a step, I think, into a significant escalation, which I don't think anybody wants to see. I think changing, I'll say, as opposed to regime change, but maybe changing of the guard, is maybe a little more palatable way of looking at how does this resolve itself in a way that doesn't result in some general war escalation. And I think that's kind of where it plays out.
Yeah. Alex, any final thoughts as we close the show? Any final thoughts on how you see, you know, the challenge with China over Taiwan in particular playing out, or China's relationship to Russia and how that plays out?
The Chinese and the Russians, at least they're hungry and they want something and they're going for something. Whereas we just want the status quo, and we really don't want anyone bothering us and creating problems that we didn't anticipate. We thought that basically dismantling our nuclear capability to the bare minimum would cause other countries to do the same, and that's not what happened. And as much as we don't want to get involved and we wish people would just leave us alone and just play by the rules, that's not happening. And I don't think that we're going to be up for challenging China if it tries to take Taiwan. I mean, there's a lot going on. There's things we can do to make it harder for the Chinese to do that. But that's just something that's going to be manifold times more challenging than what we're seeing in Ukraine with Russia. And if we can barely manage Ukraine, there's no way we're going to handle Taiwan. So I'm not saying give up, but I'm just saying we have to really try to think a little bit more, less in terms of carrots and more in terms of sticks, because they operate more from a stick than a carrot approach. And we've been trying to dangle carrots in front of the Chinese and Russians since the 1990s, even before that, but especially since the 90s. And it hasn't gone anywhere. We haven't received any thank you letters for what we've done. We've only received threats.
Yeah, and it also seems like, you know, we've been trying to play a football game. You know, I love Alabama football, and we've been trying to play football to where the score at the end of the game is 0-0. You know, nobody wins, nobody loses, we all get along, everybody's okay in the end. That seems to be how we tried to play this game, because we, you know, we're, like you said, a status quo power, and I'm not sure that's going to work.
Mm-hmm. I think that's a fair assessment. And you know, status quo for us is we're on top, right? So don't change that. And we're willing to take some on the edges. But you know, the world gets a vote, and so and we're seeing that being challenged in space, in cyber, in nuclear. And in conventional, but you know, where do you see the actual deterrence taking place? The actual deterrent structure is, in my mind, is in the nuclear structure. It's the ultimate arbiter of a deterrent posture that enables all the others to move with freedom. And with the lessening of that, as politically palatable as that may seem, it really unhinges your strength in the other elements. And so I think we're looking at a difficult road ahead.
Well, Alex, we're down to our last few seconds, so I wanted to give you the last word as we close out the show.
I like Mike's last word, so I'll just stick with that one.
You know, in future shows, one of the things we never talk about, and as we write articles and we contemplate these issues, we never talk about the guns and butter debate. Because if you look at U.S. spending, we're spending about 3.5% of GDP on defense. So it's at the lowest it's been, you know, in my lifetime. And we're facing, you know, more adversaries with more capability than we've seen. And it might be time to at least discuss, should we reverse spending and spend far less on butter and far more on guns? Because it's, you know, it's a great power maintains its success through its economic prosperity. And that economic prosperity is often bought by keeping the sea lanes open, by keeping, you know, keeping space open, you know, keeping cyberspace open. And so for us as that great power, we really need to think, is it time to invest more to do that, to ensure future economic prosperity? But that's a discussion for another show. So Mike Carey, Alex Littlefield, thanks for joining me to discuss the future of Russia and China and what happens after war. It was a great discussion. And of course, I want to thank you, the listeners, for joining us on this episode of the NIDS View. You can always listen to, you know, we have other podcasts. There's not only there's NIDS Knowledge, which if you want a 10-minute lecture on a topic of your choice, you can go there, listen to that. Twice a month, we have Real Space Strategy with Chris Stone. And then once a month, we have Deterrence Down Under with the NIDS fellows from Australia. And then, of course, you can listen to my other podcast, interview-style podcast, which that's NucleCast, done with the Advanced Nuclear Weapons Alliance Deterrence Center. So there's lots of podcasting. And then, of course, there's Global Security Review. And then Curtis McGiffin handles our Twitter feed. So if you want to hear his musings and the articles he thinks are great, just hit NIDS up on Twitter. So, of course, join us when and where, and send us your comments and your thoughts. And we, of course, want to remind you, not only thank you for listening, but we want to remind you to always think deterrence.
Thank you for listening to the NIDS View. This show is produced under the NIDS Podcasting Network, a division of the National Institute for Deterrence Studies. NIDS is a 501c3 organization dependent upon donations to provide this podcast and bring about awareness of the peacekeeping value of U.S. strength and our national deterrence. You can catch all of our podcasts or provide feedback at thinkdeterrence.com. I would like to thank our producer, Kimberly Charrington, our sponsors, and all the fantastic members of the National Institute for Deterrence Studies for making this podcast possible. Stay tuned next week for another exciting and informative The NIDS View.